and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I'm David Bax. Crickets. Just me. No one else is here. It's just me to do, because I'm the only one from Battleship Pretension who made the trek to Park City this year for the annual Sundance Film Festival. The second one since the pandemic, but this one really felt like Sundance was back in a lot of ways in terms of the turnout and the lines and stuff like that. Although, as mentioned on last week's episode, it is a bummer that they're down a number of screening rooms from before. But that's the reason I'm here today. Tonight, when I'm recording this, is to discuss the Sundance Film Festival. But before I do that, I want to tell you about TweakedAudio.com. TweakedAudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. Today, I was using them to listen to an album called The Garden by a band called Hanging Garden. And it sounded great. As usual, it's metal music, but I don't have much time. I've got to get to telling you about all the movies that I saw at Sundance. So just go to tweakedaudio.com. They're available for a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com, these earbuds. But if you use the offer code Pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code Pretension.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Okay, we're back. I'm back, and I am ready to jump in. Let's get into it, shall we? Let's talk about Sundance 2024, Sundance Film Festival 2024. I mentioned the festival being back in many ways in terms of like how many people were there, because I guess people, you know, the first year back last year, people were a little bit cautious, but yeah, it felt like there were a lot of people, but also it was back in the sense that saw a lot of really good movies, something that didn't happen last year. Last year I saw Past Lives and I saw Other People's Children, and then there's kind of a big drop-off, as I recall, until the next sort of level of quality. But this year I saw, it's still Sundance. I saw some bad movies, but I mostly saw really good stuff. And many things that were good in a surprising way, a distinctive way. And that's going to be true of my first movie. I got three movies in on the day that I got there. It had to do with an early flight, but also press screenings on the first day starting earlier than they usually do. So that was great for me. So I went straight, once I got my badge, I went straight to see a movie by director Chris Nash, and the movie is called In a Violent Nature. This is the first of two movies that I will be talking about in this episode that are very traditional, recognizable horror genres, but that adopt their own point of view quite literally by focusing more on the monster, if you will, than the victims or whatever. I mean, this is it's not uncommon. In a Violent Nature is a slasher movie. It's got a very traditional sort of setup. When you zoom out to the 30,000 foot level, it's got a very traditional setup of like a bunch of kids are staying the weekend at a cabin in the woods, and they accidentally awaken a sort of semi supernatural slasher, and he kills his way through most, if not all, of them. I'm not going to give anything away there. What Chris Nash has pulled off here is pretty terrific in terms of tone. The movie is, there's a self-awareness. Like, a lot of the dialogue that you hear among the young folks, the cannon fodder, if you will, is almost it feels almost like what's what I'm looking for, like a platonic ideal, a sort of like replacement, like I've been using replacement level too much, just sort of, man, I am drawing a blank on the word that I'm looking for. Stereotypical, archetypal, like teen or young adult, like dialogue, because the movie is aware of and knows that you're aware of what this type of movie is, and so there's, like I said, there's a sense of humor to the movie. The kills, to use slasher fan terminology, the kills, some of them in particular are very, very darkly funny. I mean, there's some really gross and inventive shit that happens, but at the same time, the movie is also taking on the point of view of this, like I said, semi-supernatural entity who is driven to kill, and we don't fully understand his motives or why he kills in the way that he does, but also the movie kind of, by often being behind him, it's adopting his point of view in a way, but not truly his point of view because it's behind him. It rarely shows you his face. The movie is also putting you or making you wonder, does he even know why he's doing this? Or did these young people by, you know, disturbing the forces, blah, 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 did they set him on a path that he just has to get to the end of, but he doesn't know why? Is it all just instinct at this point, these killings? And so the movie is weirdly existential and pensive and pondering and sad, but also, like I said, funny and just sometimes just shockingly gory and violent. Yeah, so a really strong start, being, you know, not one we're likely to see. It's not going to be this year's Coda. I don't think it's going to end up winning Best Picture, but that's not because it's not, I think it's a better movie than Coda, but it's just not that kind of movie. I saw it at a press and industry screening, like I said. I kind of wish that I had been able to see it with the midnight crowd, because I think I'll bet they ate it up when it played at midnight, and that would have been so much fun. But I almost exclusively did press and industry screenings this year, and it's not like I'm complaining, but it's because Sundance has sort of changed their press tiers, and I get very few public screening tickets allotted to me anymore. But I'm not complaining. I'm just a podcaster. I'm happy to let me do it. I'm happy I have a place that I'm able to get up there and do this, and I still see pretty much everything I want to see through the press and industry screenings. In fact, I think I prefer the press and industry screenings, because there's no big intro and there's no Q&A afterwards, and like the time it's supposed to start and end is the time it starts and ends, and it's a lot easier to stick to your schedule with the P&I screenings. So yeah, not really complaining at all, to be honest. But moving on to the next movie, a very different movie called Evelyn by director Benjamin Rhee. It's a documentary. But there's also a lot of newly created footage in the documentary. But you'll understand why when I explain. The documentary is about a Norwegian family whose son had a degenerative disease and passed away in his mid-20s. By the time he died, he had been for a long time bound to a chair and only able to move his fingers, and even by the end was losing some of that mobility. After he kept a blog, they knew he kept a blog, but they didn't like know much about it. And he played World of Warcraft. That's what he did with most of his time because he couldn't do much else. And after he passed away, the family posted a short post on the blog saying what happened, and suddenly this just the responses poured in of people. It turns out he had, for the past 10 plus years in World of Warcraft, had friendships and relationships and had this full life within this game in a way that he often couldn't in you know IRL because of his physical limitations. So Benjamin Ree here and the filmmakers were granted access to the sort of logs of the activities and conversations that had happened in World of Warcraft, and so they used World of Warcraft and voice actors to recreate the story of this young man's life through the character that he created in World of Warcraft named Ibelin. The movie is a tearjerker from just a few minutes in. It's not like you'll cry at the end. It's oof. I was crying so much during this movie. On a more intellectual level, it is it feels like an interesting remnant of a more utopian vision of what the internet could be than I think we've come to live with in the age of tech billionaires and highly gamed social media that don't represent what people want to see or want others to see, and the internet has sort of been turned against us and limited us, and the idea that this is still out there, that there are still places that feel like the sort of like mid-2000s internet of people making connections, it feels like just a last outpost, a light that's still blinking on an unattended island in some way. But it's a really fantastic movie. My third one of the first day, directed by Daniel Heisel, and Julia Neiman. It's called Vini Vidi Vici, which I didn't take Latin, but I know what that means. I saw, I conquered. And it's a very dark comedy about a very wealthy German family, and the patriarch of the family is also a serial killer. And that's not a secret. It happens in the first scene. Before we know anything else about him, we know that he kills people. The satire of the movie is that it's pretty much an open secret that everyone knows, but the guy is just so powerful that no one bothers to stop him. It gets some like dark laughs out of some of the murders or other like outlandish things that happen, but it's also it's very thin and it's very obvious as satire. It kind of says what it has to say pretty early on, and even at only 86 minutes, it kind of feels like it wears out its welcome pretty early on. So that was my first bummer of the fest. The next day, I went to an actual public screening to see Theda Hamill's Stress Positions. This is a terrifically bilious farce of a movie that takes place, it starts in March of 2020, right at the very beginning of COVID and of lockdowns. And John Early plays a recently divorced, or I guess still going through a divorce, man who is living in a property owned by his soon-to-be ex-husband that is not his most well-tended-to property. And John Early's character is also caring for his nephew, his 19-year-old male model nephew, who has recently broken his leg and is bed-bound. And all of this is happening right at the beginning of COVID. And the movie does jump into the summer of 2020, and it's really a fascinating like reminder of how in weirdly between March and like June or July of 2020, how on the one hand how little had changed because we were still all, you know, homebound, on the other hand how much had changed because of how much we had gotten used to already, and also how people were starting to really fray, we're starting to want to get out despite the risks, and want to get together despite the risks, and trying to navigate different expectations of precautions, or even belief systems among different friends. The movie is hilarious. It is also one of the funnier things that happened at the screening was that Theda Hamill, in introducing the film, felt the need, based on the reception of the movie, because it was not the premiere, but felt the need, based on the reception to the movie the night prior, to sort of gently remind us that you don't have to like every character in a movie for it to be, or even any character in a movie for it to be a good movie. You don't necessarily need to like characters. Yeah, that's definitely the case here. Is everyone's kind of a different level of self-involved little shit in this movie, or sometimes just, you know, agent of anarchic sadism. They run the gamut, but the movie's hilarious. I keep saying that, but it feels like a real sort of, like, it's thumbing its nose at that, the thing you heard very much at that time, you know, early COVID, of the, we're all in this together. In retrospect, the movie is looking back and seeing a group of people who are absolutely all in it for themselves. They only care about themselves. Their morality ends at the end of their own noses. It also is very much, like, you know, I mentioned John Early being a recently divorced gay man. Most of the characters are queer, and it definitely feels like, a very different, updated take on something like The Boys in the Band, which is sort of like a portrait of queer community, quote unquote, from inside the community, that recognizes that there are things that band queer people together, but there are also a lot of personalities and trauma that turn toxic at the same time. Fantastic movie. You know, there are people who it won't be for, because it's, like I said, the characters are so unpleasant, but if that bothers you, stay away. But I found it to be terrific, and just lightning paced, and just endless forward momentum. Hold on. Okay, next up, Anna Fleck. Wait, do I have it right? Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. I always get their names mixed up. Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, who are probably best known, if you ask me, for Half Nelson, but then they also made Captain Marvel. They have, I guess, reteamed for an anthology movie called Freaky Tales that is very much, it's set in 1987 Oakland, but it feels like a post 1994 movie. That's it's like I said, it's an anthology, but they overlap and ultimately they kind of culminate in the same place, or at least most of them do. Like I said, it's called Freaky Tales. It's very much a "Hey, we're from Oakland and we love Oakland" movie, which I'm all for. I love local pride and local color. It's also very specifically anti-neo-Nazi. They're in each of the four stories, in ways small or sometimes very, very big, there are neo-Nazi protagonists. The movie is also an alternate history that plays with real events. That actually happened, and then adds sort of supernatural elements and sort of, again, Tarantino-ish wish fulfillment type of history changing elements. I don't know. I definitely talked to the movie was well received by, I think, most of the people at Sundance. Among the people that I tend to agree with, I think it was kind of poorly received. I can't go that far, to be honest. It's a fun time, I thought. And it has a bunch of cameos of people from Oakland, but include one major one that, like, I don't care if it's obvious or whatever. It's a blast. I'm not gonna spoil it for you. So yeah, Freaky Tales. It's a fun movie. It's largely derivative, and it's preaching to the choir. But it's still a fun time. And you got Pedro Pascal, is, I guess, probably the biggest name, although Ben Mendelsohn is also in it, and Jay Ellis from Insecure is in it, if you know who he is, and a lot of younger actors as well. Freaky Tales, it's a fun time. That's what I can say. Next up is Jane Schoenbrunn's I Saw the TV Glow, which was my most anticipated movie of the festival because, as listeners know, I was absolutely over the moon for We're All Going to the World's Fair. And I think this is even an improvement on that talent that says that the not only command of tone, but the curiosity about tone that was shown with We're All Going to the World's Fair, like how far can we push into these liminal spaces and these you know, the mindset of that's brought on by the internet and stuff like that. I lost my train of thought, but that's what was happening, and we're all going to the World's Fair, and now Jane Schoenbrunn has shown that they also have emotional curiosity and emotional ambitions and things that they want to unlock or put on display for audiences, even if it's messy. And I Saw the TV Glow can get very messy. So Justice Smith plays I guess at the beginning of the movie, he's an introverted middle schooler. It's the mid 90s. He very sort of cautiously befriends a high schooler named Maddie, played by Bridget Lundy Payne, who is like their character is in ninth grade in 1996, which I was in ninth grade in 1986. So this is right in my in my wheelhouse. And together, these two are obsessed with a sort of WB Network supernatural show, very obviously heavily indebted to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but also other, I don't know, Are You Afraid of the Dark? I didn't watch that, but that sort of thing. Yeah, then there becomes, you know, I imagine that there are people who will approach this movie by decoding it. And I don't think, unlike something like, it has a lot in common with something like Lost Highway, but unlike the Lost Highway, I actually do think there's a pretty clear way to decode what happens. Bridget Lindy Payne's character disappears for a long time and comes back and has some beliefs and information that she tries to pass on to Justice Smith's character, and you know, the question of what's real and what's not comes up, and if it satisfies a viewer to say that I like, you know, you like or understand the movie because you understand what it's what is happening in it, this won't be that difficult the one what's the word I'm looking for? God, I'm tired. to solve. But what sticks with me is Jane Schoenburn's emotional urgency, and the instinctive way that they create visuals or piece together various scenes, both scenes, like, you know, like I said, like what's real and what's not. There is the quote-unquote real world, but then there's also the world inside Justice Smith's head, but then there's also the world of the TV show, and the connections that Jane Schoenburn makes through editing feel, like I said, like there's just something instinctive and urgent. It just feels like, this feels like one of those movies that you can tell the artist behind it had to make this. Who knows what would have happened, but the movie is a little, you know, it's seductively beautiful in a lot of the way, same way that We're All Going to the World's Fair was, with its kind of I mean, the title, I Saw the TV Glow, is not just a clever title, that is a lot of how the movie looks, is as though it's bathed in that sort of, you know, 90s, would that be like a cathode ray TV? I don't know, maybe that's older. Pre-plasma, I guess is what I'm saying. Pre-LED TV glow. There's also some fantastic effects, and which I don't mean like it's fucking like ILM or Weta level like effects. What I mean, they're clearly like, I mean, the movie has a bigger budget than We're All Going to the World's Fair did, but you can tell the limitations of the budget, and Jane Schoenburn uses them very well, where there's CGI that is very clearly CGI, but something about that obviousness makes it even more creepy. I haven't even mentioned the movie has scary parts, like We're All Going to the World's Fair, you know, could be classified as a horror movie. I think this one would earn that too, but there's been a lot of discussion about the movie's analogies or metaphors for like body or gender dysmorphia, and I think obviously I'm very cis. I'm like boringly cis. So I haven't experienced any of that, and I would never claim to understand. But I think I Saw the TV Glow does more than anything I've ever read about that to impart A, how awful and suffocating and torturous body dysmorphia and gender dysmorphia can be, but also in a way that I don't think I'd ever really seen laid out before, how terrifying the prospect of outing yourself or transitioning can be. Trans people use the term dead name to refer to their former name before coming out, before transitioning. And this movie does kind of make me understand why they would use that, and why, like, no matter how much you want to be your true self, there is also a self that you've created that you kind of have to kill off, maybe. And that is terrifying. There is a kind of death that is undergone in the process. And there's been, you know, more and more over the past decade, there's been more and more media about trans people, and it's been wonderful. It's obviously been very instructive for people like me, who, like I said, just irritatingly cis. But that a lot of it has been just that, just instructive, aimed at a cis audience. And I Saw the TV Glow feels like it's made by someone in the in a non-traditional part of the gender spectrum, for other people in their shoes, and in a way it's all the more instructive for that. So yeah, it was my most anticipated movie going into the festival, and is absolutely my favorite movie of the festival. And which really sucks for the next movie. It's really a bummer that I went straight to this other movie, because I really disliked Sam and Andy Zucchero's Love Me. Love Me is a post-human science fiction movie in which a buoy floating in the ocean of an Earth that's no longer inhabited by humans, that is equipped with artificial intelligence and internet connectivity, is still floating out there hundreds of years after mankind has either all perished or left the planet. And it's still out there, you know, beeping and dinging and booping and floating and stuff. And just happens to connect with a passing satellite, who is also artificially intelligent and stores a lot of human internet history, I guess. It stores all of human history via the internet, which I think, well, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but I think that is kind of the point of the movie, that it ends up making pretty clumsily. Kristen Stewart voices the buoy, Steven Yeun voices the satellite. They connect, and then they use the internet, essentially, what's still left over from all these centuries before, to concoct personae, and they have a love story. And where I think the movie is trying to, I think, make a point about constructed personas, and how they aren't real, but then it can't seem to see a solution other than the internet, so they become real by looking on the same internet they looked at to make themselves unreal. But in addition to, I mean, that's almost nitpicking compared to, like, the movie itself is just so obnoxious. And so pleased with itself and its sort of, visual, ingenuity, or I guess that's what it would say, that it, because it imagines physical spaces for avatars that look like Kristen Stewart and Steven Yeun to inhabit, so these scenes aren't just like a buoy and a satellite, you know, blipping and beeping at each other. They're actual human characters as it goes on inhabiting a space, and it just all felt a little too pleased with itself, a little too pat, and a little too like late model Pixar-y, which obviously WALL-E is a clear reference point here. But yeah, that was a real bummer for me. All right, moving on to the next day, saw a fantastic movie called Didi, D-I-D-I, directed by a guy named Sean Wang, and it is a coming-of-age movie, which, I mean, there are so many of them, but the format endures for obvious reasons. It's universal, and it's also specific to each person, and that's, you know, that's Battleship Retention's sweet spot, as you've heard us talk about before. So in Didi is a, I don't know, I'm bad at with kids' ages, 12-year-old? I don't know. He's a boy in Fremont, California in 2008, who is son of Chinese immigrants and is... spends most of his days hanging out with his other fuck-up friends who just fucking around in these suburban neighborhoods and, doing stuff the 12-year-old boys do. But then a number of things happen or are on the verge of happening. His older sister, who's also fantastic. I should look at the cast, because Didi, the kid and the sister are both so good in the movie. She's about to go off to college. This is 13-year-old Taiwanese-American. See, I don't know anything. Isaac Wang plays the main character Chris, and the older sister is played by Shirley Chen, and their mother is played by the great Joan Chen. The sister's about to go off to college. In the meantime, Chris is crushing on a girl for the first serious time, and also he has managed to run into some slightly older skateboarder kids. In his hobby of shooting videos of his friends doing dumb shit and putting it on YouTube sort of parlays its way into, or he parlays it into shooting skate videos for these older kids. And so there's a touch of Jonah Hill's mid-90s here, of this like young kid hanging out with these more mature, but not that mature skateboarders. I mean, everything about it is clearly very personal to Sean Wang, and there's a great attention to detail without it being suffocated in detail, that is really transportive not only into, you know, 2008 Fremont, California, but also into the shoes and behind the eyes of this kid and all the things that are recognizably universal to, or recognizable to me as someone who was a 12-year-old boy in the suburbs, but, or 13-year-old, I guess it says, in the suburbs, but also the things that are very specific to being the son of immigrants and things like that. So it's got all the ingredients, and it really knocks it out of the park. It's a fantastic coming of age movie. Then I went to see the Zellners' new movie, the Zellner Brothers' new movie, Sasquatch Sunset. And it's got, you know, I guess Hook, or at least it's got, not in the movie, but I guess in the description of the movie, it's about a family of Sasquatches, two of whom are played by Riley Keough and Jesse Eisenberg, but they're not really that recognizable. I mean, Riley Keough is, you could tell who she is because there's only one female Sasquatch in the movie, so that's pretty clear. But, and it's an entire, you know, 90-minute movie with no dialogue because Sasquatches don't speak English. They mostly just grunt at one another. And it's... There's a lot of dumb shenanigans and humor, a quote-unquote humor, that is not my kind of humor, unfortunately. There are also some other incidents that are kind of... There's at least one, actually, sequence that is, like, harrowing and tragic in the way of, like, a weird way... like a weird comparison to like Incredible Journey or something like that. But other than that, I don't want to talk. I want to avoid spoilers, but there's also no way for me to talk about what the movie is really about. Not that it's really a spoiler, but, I mean, you get the sense as it goes along that this family of Sasquatches might be the only ones left, or might be one of the few left, the problem is that the movie is too into its like silly, let's watch these like humans in like fairly convincing simian costumes behave like animals, that it kind of takes until the very end of the movie to actually find some poignancy in the idea of this animal being close to extinction and make the correlation to increasingly obvious truth that we are all living on a dying planet and humanity ourselves don't have that much more time. I respect the effort, but it's mostly just pretty boring up until the very end, and it's not enough to redeem itself. Next up is a Norwegian movie that multiple people described as a reunion between Worst Person in the World co-stars Renata Reinsve and Anders Danielsson Lee. And it is true that they're both in this movie. It's called Handling the Undead. It's directed by Thea Vissendahl. But they don't have any scenes together. The movie is not... The movie is... Apparently it's based on a novel by the same person who wrote the novel that Let the Right One In is based on. And that does not surprise me at all, because again, it is a take on a familiar supernatural monster type of trope. It's a zombie movie, as the Handling the Undead should make clear. But... it's mostly very domestic in its settings, and there's not like a lot of action horror. There is some horror, there is some blood and gore as it goes on, but not kind of what you have come to expect from the like post George Romero zombie movie. it basically, it tells three different stories of people who have recently lost someone in their lives. And then, for whatever reason, the zombie thing happens. And some people who, like, recently died come back. But, of course, not themselves. They're fucking zombies. But, of course, this isn't Shaun of the Dead. This doesn't take place in a world where people know what zombies are. Like, a lot of zombie movies, people are like, just like, what the, like, what is going on? But they're less scared, and they're more just like, in whatever way, this person that I love is back. And they're trying. I think this is the movie's central poignancy, is this and human universal tragedy, is that they're trying to reclaim something that can't be reclaimed, and ignoring the obvious signs that this is not going to be what they want it to be. You know, that might be your son at home laying in his bed, in only the most technical sense, but I mean, look at his fucking face. It's all rotted off and shit. That's clearly not what you want it to be. The movie is very slow moving, very quiet. Sometimes I do think a little bit too slow, to be honest. I mean, I'm not normally one to complain about movies being slow. I like slow movies. But I do think there's a lot of wasted time, or maybe not a lot, because more than not, I like the movie, but I do think it's a little, sometimes it goes too long with the lack of incident. But then it does kind of make up for that by having some pretty brutal, upsetting, horrifying stuff happen. not a home run by any means, but definitely a fascinating movie handling the undead. Next up. So, most of what I see at Sundance are movies that are premiering at Sundance, even though I'm not attending the premieres anymore. But they also have a section they call the Spotlight section, which they play stuff that is played at other festivals but hasn't yet been released in the U.S., which means I jumped at my chance to see Richard Linklater's Hitman before it comes out on Netflix later this year. It's just amazing, Hitman. It's very loosely inspired by a true story of a guy who was not a cop, who found work basically going undercover as a pretend hitman to try and entrap, as some people would accuse, people who wanted to hire a hitman to kill someone, and arrest them for attempted murder. Like I said, that's the premise. Most of the stuff I think that happens in the movie did not happen to the real guy, whose name is Gary Johnson. He's played by Glenn Powell, who's fantastic in the movie. The story really starts off kicks off proper when he meets one of these people who's trying to have someone killed, but he talks her out of it because he loves her so much. And she's played by Adria Arjona, who was in Triple Frontier. She's been in a few things. The Belko Experiment. I actually remember her in that, even though I didn't like that movie very much. And the two of them together, Glenn Powell and Adria Arjona, the chemistry, my God, I'll tell you, it's insane. They fall in lust with one another, as either any of us would, confronted with these two personalities and physiques and faces. Their chemistry means we are on their side, both as a couple and in whatever might come up against them. And Richard Linklater, there's something about his style that feels like so easy. It feels like he, you know, you go into a scene going like, oh yeah, the camera's there because that's where the camera would be. Kind of a, you know, basic choice. But this, the as it builds, you realize just how in control he is, and how what seemed like a basicness maybe early on is actually just a complete sense of comfort and confidence in what he wants to show you and how he wants to show it to you and at what pace. I mean, we've talked a lot on this podcast and just on, you know, film Twitter and just generally, like, film fans have talked about how some of the, like, star-driven, competently made, mid-budget, romantic or thriller or whatever genre type movies that were so common in the 90s now feel like lost treasure. Hitman is exactly that kind of movie. I would love for Netflix to give it an honest theatrical run. I don't know that they will, but I'm so glad I saw it in a theater full of people, and I hope other people get to see it that way too. It's exciting, tense, hilarious, and sexy, and just it's an absolutely just a quietly magnificent achievement. Mountainous. It's amazing. Okay. Moving on to, oh no, yeah, another bummer for me was Susanna Fogel's Winner. I'm a Susanna Fogel fan. I love Life Partners, and I liked Cat Person, which I saw at Sundance last year. Winner is based on the story of Reality Winner, the NSA contractor turned whistleblower, leaker, whatever you want to call her. Yeah, I like Susanna Fogel up until then. Reality Winner is played by Emilia Jones from the aforementioned Coda and the aforementioned Cat Person, and I like her a lot. But this movie is, like, obnoxiously, like, not only on Reality Winner's side, which a lot of people are, but obnoxiously insistent on her almost badassness or boss B-ish. I don't know. Yassified, I think, is the term. I don't know. I'm not cool enough to use that term. But it's really unfortunate because you've got Catherine Newton plays her sister, Zach Galifianakis plays her father. You've got a good cast here. Connie Britton is her mother. Connie fucking Britton is in this movie and still couldn't save it from just being a little too obnoxious with its, like, its voiceover, especially when she's like, you know, at the beginning it does the, like, it's very much like, I bet you're wondering how, that's me, I guess you're wondering how I got myself into that situation. Not that literally, but it's that type of thing where she's like, I leaked NSA documents. Yeah, they don't like it when you do that. Something like that. It's really obnoxious, and the whole movie kind of continues with that tone. It's a real bummer, and I do think that making these kinds of movies over and over again is just going to keep people from appreciating how talented Emilia Jones is. So let's move on to, I mentioned right up top that there were two horror movies that played with points of view. The next one is Steven Soderbergh's Presence. Only this one is not a slasher movie. This is a ghost story where the camera is it's the ghost's point of view. It's a haunted house story about a family who move into a new home, and there's already something living in it that's floating around and looking at everything. It's really fantastic. In fact, like the more distance I have from it, the more I appreciate Soderbergh's experimental, like, sort of willingness to not only take on this sort of like different point of view of a haunted house story, but also use it to do different things. So this family that moves in, they have problems, the domestic drama is really ends up being more of the point, and then it brings in other elements from outside the immediate family, but in many ways tied up in the, you know, the daughter's relationship with her, contentious relationship with her with her brother, and her grieving a friend and her need for connection. In a way, you know, there were where was I? Jesus. All right. Sorry, I'm really thrown off here. What I was saying is, the reports of people like being like thinking the movie was too intense and not being able to handle it, and walking out of the movie, and that was before I saw it. I read those, and watching it, like, the movie is not, the ghost stuff is not what's really scary about the movie. There are other things that happen. And I'll bet that the people who found the movie too intense probably had nothing to do with the ghost stuff. But yeah, I guess I think I'm getting tired, and that's why I keep losing my train of thought. But fantastically well acted. Lucy Liu and Chris Sullivan play the parents. The kids are played by Eddie Madej and Kalina Liang. Kalina Liang is, as the movie goes on, I would say the lead, as the story focuses more on her. A really great domestic drama, a new way of telling a domestic drama, and, you know, a sibling drama, and a, you know, dealing with your first loss of a loved one type of drama. It's really well done, and as time goes on, I'm more and more impressed when I think of what he did, what Soderbergh did. Okay, home stretch here, and I'm sorry that I'm like losing steam, because I've got a really good movie to talk about in a bit, but first I'm going to talk about a perfectly fine movie called Realm of Satan, a documentary that was, I guess, made with the cooperation of the Church of Satan. In fact, was their backers of it, I think. This documentary is not an interview-based talking head type of, like, here's how the Church of Satan is. It's just a series of tableau, really, of the Scott Cummings setting up the camera and lighting a situation and letting the people do their satanic thing. And they're playing to the camera very much. Some of it is like really fucking cool and metal. But a lot of it, especially as it goes on, I think is kind of poking fun at these guys, these men and women, that like they think they're dangerous and cool, but they are really just a bunch of incredible dorks. but I still don't think the movie dislikes them, or that Cummings dislikes them. I think he finds them charming, and I find them charming too. But it does, he does add some effects at points that make it seem like he's like some badass effects, like a car leaving a trail of flames behind, but it's like badass in a way that a dorky guy would think was badass. And I think that's, there's an awareness there. But then the movie also has, especially in the early going, some really fascinating stuff. You watch a live goat, watch a goat give birth. I mean, that's, you thought I was going to say something. I was, movie about Satanists, and I said, watch a goat get, or whatever. You thought I was going to say something else, but no, you watch a goat give birth on camera. There's a lot of fascinating stuff, and it's very well staged, these various tableaux. But I also think some of the silliness keeps it from being as impactful as it should, but also the silliness is kind of part of the point, I guess. Okay, we're on to my last movie, and guess what? After I saw The TV Glow and Hitman, this is my the third in my top three, and this is India Donaldson's Good One. This is a story of a I think she's supposed to be 18 year old girl, whose parents are divorced. She is spending a camping weekend with her father, played by James LeGros. And you get the impression this is something they've done multiple times over the course of their lives. This is a thing they do together. They're supposed to be going with, or they are going with James LeGros' friend, whose name is Danny. The actor's, I gotta look it up. It's Danny something. He was on Somebody Somewhere. If any of you watched that. Short-lived and much missed HBO series, Danny McCarthy, and he is very recently divorced, and so it's a sort of not quite meandering, but a leisurely paced story of an 18-year-old girl and two divorced guys in their 50s, tromping through the woods and camping, and, you know, there's plenty of fantastically naturalistic performances and dialogue, a lot of it funny, a lot of the different sort of points of view of, like, how a guy who has just been divorced sees himself, and how he is seen by someone, you know, 35 years younger, who is also the child of divorce themselves. There's some good character stuff. There's some comedy as well. And the movie is just so, there's such intimacy and such curiosity about the characters, and also such a willingness to let us be curious and to give us the space to observe these characters, to maybe come up with some answers to our curiosities. The difference is, to me, what it comes down to is the difference between, like, an 18-year-old is at the beginning of a new chapter in their life and has a lot of possibilities. A recently divorced person is also the beginning of a new chapter in their life, and but might not have as many possibilities as they think they do. in front of them. Because, yeah, not only are they older, but times have changed and they maybe don't understand how everything works in the world anymore. And all of this comes through without any sort of big speech scene or explanation or thesis statement. This is all woven into the dialogue and the silences, and it's really just beautiful. The main girl is played by Lily Collius, and then I mentioned James Lugo and Danny McCarthy. Those are the main characters in the movie. The last thing I guess I'll say about it is that it feels like there's something a little bit tragic about the way that Sam, this girl, no matter how much she knows about her dad and maybe the ways in which he can't ever be the person she would like him to be, because he's her dad, she can't stop hoping he'll be that. The movie is just absolutely lovely and beautiful, and also I would say there are parts that are very upsetting as well that I don't want to get too deep into, because I want people to discover them and have their own reaction to them the way that I do, but that's the last one that I saw. So glad I got to go to Sundance again. Thank you for listening to me prattle on for an hour, and to the guy who doesn't like it when I say I'm sorry. This was not an episode for you. That guy's probably not listening anymore, unfortunately. I'm sorry. Yeah, you can find... Hopefully I'll get some reviews up of these movies. Until then, take these as the reviews. And you can find... You'll be able to find them at BattleshipPretension.com. You can find my other podcast, The One Where I Met Your Mother, there. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Davey Pretension. Email me at David@BattleshipPretension.com. Follow me on Letterboxd at David Backs. And yeah, other than that, thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.